Mrs. Mitchell, real tone.
People said to my mother, your husband's probably scarfed over the Dutch border. And my mother said, no way, not my husband. He wouldn't leave us here, and there's no question about that. But nobody knew, so in the first 24 hours, of course, on the, I think it was the night of the 10th of November, they came, another lot of thugs came with them, staves and knocked the windows, and there were shutters. I mean, it wasn't dramatic. I mean, must have been terribly scary for the adults in the household. But again, I don't know that Hans and I were so scared. I don't think we were. And then my mother decided she'd better... Oh, no, then the next day, the Gestapo came and asked my mother where my father was. I should explain that the nearest Gestapo headquarters to the Dutch border was our town. And for quite some while before, don't ask me how long because I don't remember, but I've had this confirmed by both my aunt, whom I met years later after the war, when she came to visit us from Buenos Aires. And my mother used to be terrified because my father, I don't think I look very Jewish. My father looked even more un-Jewish than I do. And had established a relationship with the major who was in charge of the Gestapo headquarters, and they bribed him heavily. And when there were people caught at the border, they were chucked into the Gestapo prison in Münster. And the major used to ring my father or my uncle and say, we've got one, or we've got several, or whatever. And Daddy and Uncle Fritz used to go down to Gestapo headquarters, and used to go into the cells, and make up some cock and bull story why these people had been caught without permission to enter the country or leave your Germany. And the Dutch couldn't have cared less, but the Germans certainly could. And the first time I think Daddy went in there, they thought he was a stool pigeon because he looked so non-Jewish, and made up some story about you were going to see your brother who's desperately ill and you couldn't wait for a visa, etc., etc., or an exit permit. And so they must, I don't know what they did. My aunt told me an extraordinary story years after the war, that she and my mother used to sit there terrified while the fellows were there, used to go together, the two men, and put cushions over the telephones in case they were bugged. I mean, you know, the sophistication of bugging as, you know, obviously a scam, but, I mean, who would have known in those days anyway? But they thought that was a precaution, so that if they talked to each other, they couldn't be heard, they figured. And so the Gestapo came to the house and asked Mummy whether she knew where's her husband. And my mother said, A, I don't know, and B, if I did, I wouldn't tell you. And they said, you know, we're genuinely trying to help. And mother said, words to the effect of, tell that to the Marines. And so I think whether it was the second night or the third night, I really don't know. The third day, the police came in and looked for firearms. Now, one of my father's hobbies also was game shooting. He had a share in a, I think they call it a shoot, don't they?
Yes.
And so we did have guns in the cellar. And so they took those. That was perfectly okay as far as my mother was concerned. But I think the Gestapo came before the police on that day, and when they heard the police were coming, they asked to be hidden. The Gestapo asked to be hidden because the police were coming in. It was a weird story, I imagine. And so she shuffled them from one place to the other so they wouldn't run into each other. And the Gestapo said to her again, where was your husband? Well, this time, my mother said, the last time I heard from her husband, I don't know whether she mentioned Wiesbaden or not, but was, in fact, the night of Gestapo. Whether they called it in those days, I wouldn't know. But that night, too, she decided she'd go to Wiesbaden. And this Fräulein Hein, this non-Jewish secretary, who had only just passed the driving test. My mother was an expert driver, but everybody thought it would have been crazy for her to go on her own. And because Fräulein Hein was not Jewish, it might have been easier for her, because, of course, everybody by that time had identity cards with a J in them. And so these two ladies set off to drive through the night, because they want to leave us as little as possible, to drive to Wiesbaden, which I think is quite a way from Münster, but don't ask me what the distance is. And to try to track down where my father could have been. And they got in touch with his customer, they got in touch with the hotel. And the customer said, I had dinner with him the night before he left. He said he was going back the next morning. And I don't know. And he was, I mean, he was obviously not a Jewish customer, but obviously a very nice one. My father had some very nice non-Jewish customers, incidentally. And while I'm on the subject, there was one. They were friendly with an old lady called Maria von zu Mühlen. She was sort of minor German aristocracy. And her brother came home after Kristallnacht. Whether it was Graf or not, I really don't know, whatever he was. And said at his own lunch table at lunchtime to his family, son, daughter, wife, what we've done today is an injustice which we'll never be able to put right. I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of being a German. And the next day he got arrested. And the next, and but was released shortly afterwards. He was quite an important sort of bloke. But warned not to talk against the Nazis, the party, etc., all the rest of it. And the next day, when he came home from prison, he said to his family, somebody has denounced me. Who? And his son said, I did, because you talked against my Führer. And the man went upstairs and shot himself and killed himself. I don't know whether my parents ever saw the sister again. I don't recall, but I know their heart bled for them. Because one of the peculiar things about this whole thing is that although they were aware of all the laws and all the rest of it, my father has so many of them. Because he was a businessman, and because he wasn't an academic, and because he wasn't a lawyer or a doctor, who weren't allowed to practice from 33 onwards. So, in many respects, although it was awful for them, they at least didn't have an option. They had to get out, if they could. But, of course, somebody like a businessman, or a pretty well-to-do one, who wound up his business at a time when he figured he was going to be able to support himself forever after, otherwise he wouldn't have done it, I'm sure. Felt passionately as a German, they lived there for hundreds of years. That he was a committed Jew, I've already made clear in the things I've told you about his attachment to the community. But to him, this was a nightmare which had to pass. The German people couldn't be that stupid, or that vicious, or that narrow-minded, or, you know, they were all things that played an enormous part in these people, in their minds. And as I say, my late husband and I often used to discuss this situation because his father reacted similarly. He was a banker in Berlin. So they left it really very, very late, to put it mildly. Meantime, Daddy had disappeared. They couldn't find any trace of him, and my mother tried to keep... I think we stayed upstairs for 2 days while they cleaned up downstairs. And then we were allowed down again, but we could see that the furniture was in tatters. And it was a nice home. And there was obviously a strange atmosphere. I don't think we went to school during that time because I don't think anybody would have allowed us to go out. So we stayed home. I'm quite sure because to them, education was very important. I'm sure we had to do things at home too, whatever. And 10 days later, after Kristallnacht, she got a telephone call from the Gestapo to say they'd found him in Buchenwald. They actually found him on their closed radio network. And they took him out. And as I mentioned before, he was quite a sportsman, etc., and all the rest of it, and so he also must have had quite a lot of money on him. Now, to this day, I don't know why they didn't just take the money. Because he was traveling with a suitcase. He was on his way home. What actually happened to him was that he went to the railway station in Wiesbaden, and they were rattling a tin at the barrier when he was going to get on the train to make a donation in one of these collection boxes to the Winterhofer. The Winterhofer, as you know, was a collection for the widows and disabled SS people or whatever. And my father said, no, thank you. So they immediately asked him for his identity card. And of course the identity card had a J on it. and they said to him, could you step aside for a moment? They didn't want to make a fuss in the main railway station in Wiesbaden. And my father said, well, will I catch this train? It's leaving in 15 minutes. And they said, yes, no problem at all. Very polite. And they took him down some sidings and shoved him in a wooden hut where there are other Jews. And the polite was stopped there. And he was sent to Buchenwald. And where, because he had such a, I mean, I presume, some of the prisoners also, for instance, dealt with the business of the shaven heads. My father did not have his head shaved. He gave my work a lot of money. The 10 days in Buchenwald, which he actually never talked about in Germany, only started talking about it here. Because they let him go on condition that he didn't talk about it. If not, they would get the whole family. And he never talked about it there. But he was obviously, my mother said he was never the same man again. It wasn't just the deprivation and the horror and whatever it was, because don't forget it was not an extermination camp, it was a disgusting concentration camp. Well, for instance, amongst other things, he met a man who he said looked just like, I mentioned the name, I think his name was Hirsch, but I can't remember, I think he went to school with. But he said it looked like Hirsch's father, and he's been dead for years, but it was Hirsch. And they sent Hirsch's ashes to this widow sometime later, and that's how my daddy knew that it was Hirsch in Buchenwald. But then he realized that we've got to get our skates on and get out of there. But of course, by that time, a lot of places were no longer taking Jews from Germany, Czechoslovakia, Austria, wherever. And incidentally, my parents also were very much involved, and they threw the Czech Jews out. We had a whole contingent of Czechs in our town. Some of them are still alive, and in fact, eventually were responsible for giving affidavits for my father's benefit when he was an internment here, as being one of the people who rescued them, and you know, found the funds for them to move on, whatever. And they were nice people.
These were Czech Jews from the
Sudeten. Yeah, who had been chucked out. Well, but actually, the people that we had that I remember very clearly was actually a Czech lawyer from Prague. And a devoted non-Jewish senior clerk or something like that. Don't ask me how the circumstances were. I'm sure one of the other people who interview will be able to tell that story more accurately. But they've certainly stayed in the town and stayed. I mean, they didn't stay with us at that time anymore because we actually had moved to the attic of our house, which my father had sold, in inverted commas, to our dentist. Which today is a very flourishing dental clinic, which the Sun runs. I mean, I'm talking about early 1991 when I was there. But this man was called Immenkamp. And I think he behaved perfectly decently, by the way. But whether my father ever got the money or not, I doubt, because after all, they blocked all the money then. And so they tried desperately to get visas to get out of there. And eventually managed to get a visitor's visa to England, because one of the few places that was still taking people was Trinidad. So we arrived, we left Germany on the 28th of July, 1939, it happened to be my parents' wedding anniversary, stayed in Holland until the 2nd of August, and came to England on the 3rd of August, 1939. And with no money, and went to Glossop in Derbyshire, which in itself is a story, but possibly not for this particular thing, but because my father had invested in something which, as far as he was concerned, went sour. I mean, it was illegal from a German point of view, totally illegal from an English point of view. Somebody whose invention in industry he had backed. The man was a brilliant technician, but hopeless in business. The second time he backed him. Believe it or not, he's still alive today, and I can't talk about it. It's a great disappointment to my father what happened there. But nevertheless, we were safe. We were out of there. In the meantime, the Steinschals, the rabbi and his family, had gone to Buenos Aires with Omi. And they kept up a correspondence right through the war. But of course, my father was interned.
When you did leave Germany, were there any obstacles to leaving,
or
any experiences you had?
For my parents, Because, again, we would have known very little about this. I mean, we were kids of 9 and 10 at the time, or 10 and... I think I was, you know, we left it in July. I was 10 in June. And for my parents, yes, because they transported all their furniture and in these lifts, as they called them, you know, which is, you can see them today, I mean, on the back of international removal companies and stuff. And remember, we were allowed to take a few things of our own, I mean, the children. You know, I remember 5 books of mine which completely got lost. And I never forgave my parents. I thought they'd been taken out for something else. I mean, I'm sure not so. But they had to, you know, they had to get that done and get the stuff out. And indeed, on the way out, this major that I was talking about before said to my father, put a few things in your trunks, a few valuables. Because, of course, they left most things behind, but they did take them. They sort of, in the lifts were for things like our cutlery, which was decent, and good china, and all that sort of jazz, you know, and furniture, loads of furniture. And the major said to my father, pack a few things into your trunks, it'll be all right, because I'll come to the border and see you off. So we got to the border, and first of all, they were most unpleasant. I mean, obviously on the German side, and the Dutch were fine. On the German side, and insisted on a strip search of the 4 of us. And then they were going to open the trunks. And my father, I must have been kind of brave, man. Incidentally, one of the reasons, of course, he was a veteran of the First World War. He was a second lieutenant in the German Marines, which is unusual for a Jew, by the way, to have a commission. And so that's one of the other reasons that they didn't think it would ever happen to them. Yeah? And so my father started shouting the odds at these fellows at the frontier. Go and ring your staff headquarters. They'll tell you where to get off. And I must say, when I think about it now, my goosebumps will get goose pimples. But they came back, yes sir, no sir, 3 bags full. But no major from the Gestapo. But there was a telegram. The reason I can't remember the name of the major was because of the telegram. The telegram read something like, unavoidably detained, wish you and your family well in the future, best wishes, signed Gutenberg. Now Gutenberg was the street where the Gestapo headquarters was. And that was that. But my father yelling at these people and telling them to ring up Gestapo headquarters, and they're coming back, yes sir, no sir, 3 bags full, being polite, helping us over, whatever. And then when we got to Holland, some of my father's friends tried to persuade him to stay. Because I don't think he spoke Dutch, but he certainly understood it, and we did to a certain extent as well, because he spent a lot of time there. And it was, you know, continent, and it was Europe, and it was more familiar surroundings. Why go to England? And all I can say is, thank God they did. But of course, he had no work permit here in England. And we moved into an old-fashioned house in Glossop in Derbyshire, quite a big house, which is the mill owner's house, which had been rented for us by these business acquaintances who were going to be so helpful to him and weren't. And there really was no money. I think my father sold a few shares in the business, but didn't want to sell many. We were actually befriended. When my father was interned, and the internment didn't happen immediately, of course, we were befriended, I think, from day one by the local Church of England vicar and his wife, Bill and Vera Chivers. And they came to see us. There were no Jews in Glossop. There were 6 Jewish refugee families, most of whom didn't speak to each other, for a variety of reasons. And apart from that, the locals hadn't seen Jews before. And Glossop, as you may know, was a depressed mill town. That's why the business was set up there. Which, as I say, my father never participated in. Not for want of trying. And this Bill Chivers and his wife Vera, Vera's still alive, came to my parents and said, was there anything they could do to help? And they, in fact, taught them English. They were lovely, lovely people. My father's English actually was very good. The accent was appalling. The vocabulary was enormous because he was a sort of bloke. My mother's English was always appalling, and her vocabulary was poor too. Both of them spoke with an accent. Of course, we as children were very embarrassed when we came to England about the accent of our parents. After all, we had that ourselves, but it lost it pretty swiftly. I mean, my English is pretty good, so you'll find it's my brother's. Although he has a slight intonation. I mean, I don't think I do. Well, I'm told I don't. But really, the way out was that incident at the water. And some of the stories I've told you, you'll realize I did not hear until years afterwards from my parents. And indeed, when my father started talking about what they were capable of, what they did, and all this sort of business, people didn't really believe him. So in a way, it's a very good thing to be able to put it on record.
What were your first impressions of Britain?
Well, we lived in this house in a sort of somewhat isolated way, and I remember the first impression of... It was quite exciting, of course. And, except we didn't know... I mean, because the first winter was a nightmare on wheels. Of course, we went to school. The first term we went to school was the month war broke out. And it was Bill Chivers and his wife, Vera, who said, don't send them to local grammar school. Send them... There was a co-ed boarding school called Kingsmore in the town, in Glossop. The headmaster was a Cambridge man called Swain. And he and his wife had opened this co-ed boarding school, who went as day pupils, day bugs as we were called. Because Bill Stiver said they mustn't acquire the accent, because in Germany it doesn't matter what sort of accent you speak with. But the very broad Derbyshire accent would have been a disadvantage. And my father said, well, I can't afford to send them there. So, and I think Bill went, I think, with my father to see old man Swain. And my father said, look, I can't really afford it. And Swain had already taken a lot of refugees. Not only had he taken them, but he also had refugee teachers. Not refugee teachers. Yeah, one refugee teacher, but most of them were sort of like housemen. An engineer from Vienna was a sort of boiler man. I mean, highly qualified engineer, but just to get them out. After all, what was open to people to come to, the sort of jobs to come to, was very limited, because after all, this country was suffering from a depression. I mean, it was a depressed area, and in any case, there was a high degree of unemployment. Which, of course, all that changed immediately when the war came on, but at that time, to get people out, people really did the most amazing things. And my mother found it quite difficult, housekeeping and stuff like that, to put in mildly, and they took in boarders. Because how else were they going to keep body and soul together? They had no money. And indeed, when Daddy was interned, I think she took more boarders in, and I think right through the war, more or less, she had people. Then of course, the evacuee business came up, and ours was an area which took evacuees, because we were off the beaten track. And we actually had some Jewish evacuees from London who actually had given shelter to cousins of mine. Do you remember way back at the beginning of the story I told you about the illuminated alarm clock? It was the children of those people who perished, the couple. They live here now. They are sort of cousins. We keep in touch, but we haven't developed any real closeness. But she rang me just before Pesach the other day and said, you know, it's lovely just to have a natter. And so...
So you did go to this boarding school?
We went to this school, and my father said, when I can afford it, I will pay. Which, of course, he did. We went to the school, and of course, the first day at school, there were certain things that were, I mean, I think, for instance, I'd never seen a penknife before in my life, and we got pencils that didn't have a point on them. So there was a queue, so I joined the queue. First time I remember joining the queue. And there was somebody with, I think, a scout knife or something, a sheath knife or something, sharpening their pencil. And when I got hold of this one, it was my turn to try and have a go. This boy sort of more or less took it out of my hand, pushed me aside and said, I'm not lending it to her for the little hun. But on the whole, they were lovely, lovely people. I mean, this was a startling experience as far as we were concerned. And I was in the top form of the junior school, and my brother was in the junior form of the senior school. And we did meet some awfully nice people there. And the Swains were very good, the teachers were very good. We had some refugee teachers as well. And I was, as I say, I've mentioned before, I was a lazy little so-and-so. But I enjoyed the extracurricular activities very much, because there's a boarding school, you see, so things went on in the evenings. But the sort of misunderstandings that arise, for instance, my brother, who was a much more, was and is, a much less extrovert character than I am, except when you get him going, he's absolutely marvellous. They used to have a literary society there, so in the evenings they used to have debates, or late afternoon, or whatever it is, as I say, most of them were boarders. And my brother couldn't understand why, every time somebody got up to speak, they said, Mr. Chamberlain is a gentleman. Couldn't understand it at all. It was only afterwards we put two and two together and said, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen.
But you came across a degree of anti-German feeling then.
Of course. But that I'll say, the teacher was very good. I mean, I will always thank the principal of the junior school, a woman called Dora Healy. First of all, I was an aggressive kid. And I didn't allow these things to happen and started sort of bashing about a bit. My English was pretty awful. When we first arrived in August, the only contact I had was with a farmer's boy from next door. And he spoke with a broad Derbyshire accent. And I am an unconscious mimic, but that I did consciously because I wanted to learn English, you see. And Billy, as he was called, the little boy next door, on the farm, which is right next to the house, used to have bloody this and bloody that and bloody coos. And of course, I picked that up like nobody's business, and the school didn't like it very much. Eva's English has improved greatly, but it's still very unladylike. So it stayed unladylike.
Was there any anti-Jewish feeling you came across in England?
Not in school. I'm sure not in school. Because, I mean, they were devout Christians, I think, the Swains, who, you know, and as I say, the vicar was a great guy. And in fact, it was the vicar who formulated the application to the Home Office of my parents for my father's release from internment eventually. And one of the sort of figures of my, whom I've never met and never, but of course I've come across her name many, many times, was Eleanor Rathbone, who worked very hard for the release of enemy aliens, of the category, whatever category it was. And she's sort of a legend in my own personal history, because she obviously was a great lady to do that during the war. And Daddy was not resentful about internment at all. He said, what were they to do? I know who they were up against, and I mean, a lot of people had much worse experiences, but Daddy by that time wasn't 100% well. And there was a lot of, as I say, the support from the Czechs, the support from Bill Chivers. And he wasn't in the internment very long. I think he got around partly for health reasons, but he did go to Heiden and the Isle of Man. And it must have been quite an elite group at the Isle of Man, because after the number of people I know who ended up at the Isle of Man, including some of the brightest in the national scene here now, and artistically and scientifically and you name it, whatever it was, every second person you come to in the Jewish community of that background, certainly been to the Isle of Man, And my own husband, of course, was there as well. And he was shipped out to Canada. He was